Right, so this evening we're going to look at Ha'alotcha, which is an action-packed parsha as opposed to what we've had before, where Parsha Bamidbar was, you know, about the counting of the Jewish people, and Parsha Naso, you know, had a few mitzvot here and there, and then at the end is all the gifts of the Nesiim come, and all, you have them over and over and over and over again. Parsha Ha'alotcha really has a lot in it. It begins at the mitzvah of lighting the Ha'alotcha when you go up to light the menorah, Aharon, the mitzvah of lighting the Aharon, and then it deals with the sanctification of the Levites, of the Leviim, and what their job is going to be in the Beit HaMikdash, and then the beginning of Perek Tet, chapter 9, we have the concept of Pesach Sheni. There are a bunch of people who the Midrash tells us they weren't able to do the original Pesach in Mitzrayim. I'm on page now 778, flying through the parsha. There were a group of people who, for whatever reason, weren't able to keep the original, do the Pesach, the second Pesach around, because we're now in the second year after they left. We're 1 year from leaving Egypt. So there are people who weren't able to do this second Pesach, and the Midrash tells us because they were carrying the bones of Yosef, so there was a Melamate. They said, what are we supposed to do? We missed it. So Moshe turns to Hashem and says, what are they supposed to do? And Hashem says, oh, there's a mitzvah called Pesach Sheni, that on the 15th day of Iyar, you can come, and on the 14th day, sorry, of Iyar, you can come and bring the Korban Pesach again, you know, they can have their own Pesach. Then we move into, in general, you know, this applies to everybody, Pesach Sheni. And then on page 780, we have the travels of the Jewish people, how they're dependent on Hashem. When they're ready to travel, the cloud goes up. When they're ready to camp, the cloud goes down. Page 782, then, the beginning of Perek Yud, we have the Chatzotrot, silver trumpets that were made for several purposes. And one of the purposes that they were made for was to announce that it's time to travel. And indeed, as you see on the bottom of page 782 and 783, it's in the second year of the second month, B'shana HaSheni, B'chodesh HaSheni, the second month, which is the month of Iyar. B'Eshrim B'chodesh, so the 20th day of Iyar, so this is 6 days after that, Pesach Sheni, Na'ala Ha'anan Me'al Mishkan Ha'idut, the cloud rises up. Ha'yusu B'nei Yisrael L'maseihem, the B'nei Yisrael continue on their way as per God's instructions, and they go on their way, and they go in this order, and this is how they leave, and these are the people who are leading them. We're familiar with that structure. And then we have in page 786 that interesting separate parsha with the upside down ruins that we're not going to talk about at all. And then we have the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph at the bottom of 786 and 787. Vayehi ha'am kimidoninim. The people were like fetchers. Rabbos ne Hashem, bad in the ears of God. Vayishma Hashem, God heard them. Vayicharapo, he got fuming mad. By the way, if you're familiar with the Hebrew language, you'll know that apo is his nose. Vayichar af is fuming, is the best translation, I think. Mm-hmm. Because when you're fuming, fumes are coming out. Vayichar af, the fumes are coming out of his nose, so to speak. He's, you know.
And you are mad.
But really, you know, it is more than just vayichar. That's exactly what it is. Vativ arban eish Hashem, you have this fire of God that burns in the people. Vatochal v'ksei ha'machane, the edge of the machane consumes the edge of the camp. Vayitzak ha'am el Moshe, the nation screams out to Moshe. Vayipaleo Moshe al Hashem, Moshe davens to God. Vatishka ha'eish, the fire dies down. Vayikash ha'am al komahu taveira, that place is called taveira. Ki va'arabam eish Hashem, because in that place God's fire burnt. This is the story we're going to focus on this evening. This motley crew of people among the Jewish people, they desired a desire. They sat down. And they cried. Who sat down and cried? These rabble rousers, v'gam b'nei Yisrael, and also the Jewish people. In other words, they got everybody to come and sit and fetch with them, cry with them. What was the Yomru? They said, "Mi yochi lenu basar." Right? They said, "Who is going to give us meat?" then what would you expect them to say? Who's going to give us meat? What are they eating?
They're eating the bun.
It tastes like whatever they want it to taste.
You know, I never found that in Midrash.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's.
But it looks the same.
Yep. I've never found it. Wow. That's not to say I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I haven't looked terribly hard for it. But the Torah doesn't say it. The Torah tells you exactly what it tasted like. It tasted like batter dipped honey. Honey dipped batter, fried batter.
Honey, yeah.
That's what it says it tasted like. That's what the Torah says. Mm-hmm. We'll explain to you a little bit why everyone thinks that it tasted like everything. Yeah. We're gonna get into that a little bit tonight. They say, who's gonna give us meat? And they said, could you imagine even that? Put yourself in their shoes. There's a little less than a year they've been having them on. 30 days less than a year. Mm-hmm. No, exactly a year, because this is an ER already. Mm-hmm. They have them on for a year. Even let's say it does taste like everything, right?
Mm-hmm. It looks the same.
It looks the same. It feels the same. Texture is so important. Do you know why we have Shabbos candles on Friday night? We have Shabbos candles on Friday night so you can see the food that you're eating. Also, there are several different versions of why we have candles on Friday night.
You smell it, too.
What's the difference of Midrash or for real? Isn't a Midrash for real?
Well, is it in the Torah, like you're saying, the mon?
Shabbos candles are not in the Torah anywhere. Are you going to stop lighting them?
No, I'm just...
Okay, they're not in the Torah. Shabbos candles aren't in the Torah anywhere. Never says when Torah light candles for Shabbos, right? And the halacha svarim, when it talks about why we light candles.
So we can see the food.
One of it is so that we see the food that we eat, because you enjoy the food more when you can see it.
And smell it.
Now, you know, we all, when we design our meals, we make sure that not only is there a variety of types of food, i.e. you have protein, a starch, and a vegetable. Right? Bare minimum. I'm sure most of us do a lot more than that. Are you looking for her? Not only do we make sure that there's a protein, a starch, and a vegetable, we also want to make sure that perhaps your vegetable is salty and your starch is sweet, or vice versa. You know, if you have a sweet chicken, you're not necessarily going to serve that also with a sweet starch and a sweet vegetable. You're going to have something to balance it. Plus, if you're serving chicken, you're going to have a green vegetable. You have something to contrast the colors. Colors are very important. The texture, presentation is essential to cooking. You know, you want to make sure. This is why I made an onion dip. Everything turned out orange. I don't know how that happened. So I made a green bean salad and threw in some cherry tomatoes. You know, I had my green and my red on the table. And everybody took it. It wasn't such a good recipe. Everybody left it on their plate. But everyone took it on their plate. You looked at the plate, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice... It's very important for the food to look pretty. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that it wasn't a good recipe. I wouldn't have made it. It's going to get an excellent cookbook. But anyway, here they're eating the same food all the time. They want, let's say, the feel of a hamburger, the feel of a steak, perhaps. But then that's not what they say. They say, who's going to give us meat? How would they know about meat?
Okay, so
you would expect them perhaps to say, let's say it's from their experience in Egypt, you're going to expect them next to say, we remember the meat we had in Egypt. What do they say? We remember the fish we had in Egypt.
Right.
We want meat. Who's going to give us meat? We remember the fish we had in Egypt for free. Bechinam, for nothing.
I don't understand.
One minute. What else do they remember? Etakishuim, the squash. V'etavatichim, the watermelons, v'etachatzir, v'etabitalim, v'etashumim. These other, the onion, I don't know what chatzir is.
Leeks, onions.
What does he say? Okay, leeks, onions, and garlic. These are the things we remember. Rashi says something very interesting here. He says, at hakishuim, Amar Rabbi Shimon.
How can you forget God?
Rabbi Shimon said, right, Nipneima haman mishtana l'chol davar chutz me'elim. Nipneima. Why are these the things that they're listing that they're missing? Because the man changed to anything except for these three. Okay? Mipnei shehayu kashim lemanikot. Why? Because these are things that nursing women shouldn't eat. So the man isn't going to turn into... In other words, to show you this... Back to your question, is this midrash? Is that true that the man tasted like everything? I'm not sure that was the point of the midrash.
No, but it says here that they were showing their true colors.
I don't know what where you're
Rashi.
Looking. No, I'm looking in Rashi. This is not Rashi.
With the mana.
No, that's different. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not up to that yet. I'm looking in the Rashi in the Hebrew. This English Rashi does not translate all the Rashis. It only translates select Rashis, and I will get to that Rashi. But the one that...
Same one. It's number four.
But that's not the Rashi that I read. Rashi says a lot more on that pasuk. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. So,
but he's quoting the first one. So I'm looking at the second Rashi. Why doesn't it taste like these things? Because these things are hard for a nursing woman to have. In other words, they're gassy for the baby or for the mother. They're just not good things for a nursing woman to eat. Melon and garlic and onion and leeks and squash.
By the way, is that something that a pediatrician would say today to a nursing mother?
There are foods that nursing mothers are supposed to stay away from, like spicy foods and broccoli.
And cauliflower, anything that's
gassy
foods.
Right, there are foods that, you know, but what's interesting to me, the point of this medrash is the universality of the mun and the sensitivity of the mun, so to speak. In other words, right, it's like if a small group of people can't have it, nobody's going to have it. Which is it's an interesting thing.
It sure is.
It's even more interesting if you think about it. Does that mean that the taste would take on the quality of the food? Because it's really the cauliflower that's going to be gassy, but or the onion or the garlic. But if it just tastes like it, you know, if I suck an onion flavored sucking candy, you know,
so many of these foods can be manufactured artificially in a factory. That's
now
right. So onion flavoring and garlic flavoring.
But so I'm wondering. It's a very strange thing here. That's what I'm saying. I never saw the midrash in its original form. Mm-hmm. I just really, because I never looked at it, but that's not really the focus of our talk tonight. The focus of our talk tonight, we're going to start on page 94. It's number 2. I'll be back and just turn to page 92 for a second. I'm just going to run and get the papers, but you're all being recorded, so be careful.
But like it says here that. Let's see, this is Forno. The new complaint was especially galling, for not only did they complain that their diet was insufficient, which the Torah testifies to be untrue, they went so far as to say they preferred Egyptian slavery to the presence of God.
Okay, could you take this and pass this? Thank you.
He had the ability to satisfy their belief.
Okay, page 94, number 2, fish we ate for free. After all the preparations recorded in the two preceding Sidrot for the great trek had been concluded, and the arrangements for their journeys and encampments laid down, the Israelites were commanded to make trumpets for themselves with instructions when and how to use them on the 20th day of the second month. This is what we read. Their whole progress in the wilderness was governed by the hands of divine providence, and they marched forward led by their heavenly sovereign, Api Hashem Yishu B'nei Yisrael, the Api Hashem Yechanu. By the commandment of God they traveled, by the commandment of God they camped. Their trek through the great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, as it's described later in Devarim, is a story of advancement to their goal, the land of promise, by supernatural means and accompanied by visible miracles. The generation that went through these experiences stands revealed in our Sedra as unable to cope with these suprahuman conditions. As it were, characterized by true freedom, released from outward and inner servitude, feeding on the corn of heaven and the bread of the mighty, interpreted by Rashi to imply angel's food coming directly from the Almighty's bountiful hand. Instead, she's quoting from Tehillim when she says
beautiful,
it.
Though.
Instead, we are confronted by yearnings and nostalgia for a humdrum, small-time existence, a life of serfdom subject to their habits, passions, and desires. Those were the days, they say, and we look at them. You know, every time I teach this to my students, especially teenagers who see things in black and white, but even us as adults can ask this question and say, you have miracles before your eyes every day. I mean, you're literally eating manna from heaven, you know.
And how can you
complain about this? God's hands is in front of you. What is there to complain about? You know, it's hard for us to understand it. And here they're remembering, but even more so. Well, let's look into that. That's going to be the focus of what's going on here. Those same longings to return to the flesh parts of Egypt came to the surface as soon as they were confronted on their departure by the first signs of impending danger. And if you'll take a minute and turn back in your Chumashim to Parshat Beshalach, when Hashem, they cross over the Yam Suf, after they sing their praises to God, Parshat Zion, chapter 16, I'm on page 382 and 383. And this is their first time that they complained. By Yisum Elim, they travel from Elim, by Avol Kol Adap Bnei Yisrael Midbar Sin, they come to the Midbar of Sin, Asher Bein Elim Ovein Sinai, which is between Elim and Sinai. V'chamishash Hayom L'chodesh Hasheni L'Tzeitam Mitzrayim. So we're going back a year, to the 15th day of the year, right after they left Mitzrayim. What do they say? Vayilonu kol adap bnei Yisrael al Moshe v'al Aaron. The entire Jewish people complain about Moshe and Aaron. And what do they say? In the desert, v'yom alei bnei Yisrael, they say them. Mi yuchein mocheinu b'yad Hashem b'eretz Mitzrayim. We wish we would have died by the hands of God when we stayed in Mitzrayim. V'shiteinu al sir habashar. When we sat on the pot of flesh, of meat, v'achleinu lechem l'sova, when we ate bread to fill ourselves, to satiation, ki yotzeitam otanu l'minbar zeh, you brought us out to this desert, l'hamit et kol ha'kal ha'dabarad, to kill us all with famine. And God's answer to them is to bring them the man. He says, you know what, you're right. You have a right to complain. This is a month already you've been traveling. How much food could you have brought with you? Not more than a month. This is it. So he gives them the man. That was the initial complaint. And now this is a whole year later, whereas before they remember sitting on the words, that the way she translates the Sir HaBashar back in Shemot as flesh pots. She calls them flesh pots. That's her reference here. When she says, here we go. The same longings, I'm back in Nechama, page 95, to return to the flesh pots of Egypt, came to the surface as soon as they were confronted on their departure by the first signs of impending danger. When they saw Egypt pursuing them, forgetful of the divine miracles they had seen but yesterday. Demoralization set in whenever some new obstacle appeared on the scene. Our Sidra and the three subsequent ones of Shalach, Korach, and Chukat in particular constitute a record of the little faith, lack of faith, and ingratitude displayed by the Dor HaMidbar, the generation of the wilderness, turning its back on freedom and preferring servitude. It's mind-boggling to us. It's succumbed to a rapid process of demoralization, descending from the dizzy spiritual heights of being born on eagle's wings. We did that one, remember? She spoke about being born on eagle's wings when they got the Torah, when they left and trying to get the Torah, to the degenerative status of malcontents, from being nourished by the corn of heaven to a gluttonous demand for onions and garlic. Like, here, you're getting mud. You want onions and garlic? You want Osem soup mix, you know? Like, what? I mean, it's good and everything, but come on, look what you have. That was way, way, way back, talking about God carrying them above the wings and protecting them. I can't see the stars at night, you know, from the lights and pollution where I am. I'm assuming they do. I'm assuming they do.
They do. They carry them on their wings, the female.
Okay.
The new baby eagles.
Okay.
And there's something about them, they go close to the ground. And I'm sure it comes from the Torah.
Well, it's usually, yeah. The psalmist paints a vivid picture of the spiritual backslidings of our ancestors in Psalms 106, 7 to 25, which we quote here. I'm going to read it in the English. What time are we at? Okay. I'm going to read it in English. Our fathers in Egypt, they understood not your wonders. They remembered not the multitude of your mercies provoked him at sea, even at the Red Sea. Nevertheless, he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make his mighty power to be known. He rebuked the Red Sea also, and it was dried up. So he led them through the depths, through the wilderness. And he saved them from the hands of him that hated them, and redeemed them from the hands of the enemy. And the waters covered their enemies. There was not one of them left. They believed in his words. They sang his praise. They soon forgot his works. They waited not for his counsel, but lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert, and he gave them their request. That's what I read to you before. But sent leanness into their soul. They envied Moshe also in the camp in Aaron, the saints of the Lord. The earth opened and swallowed up Datan and covered the company of Abiram. That's a reference to Korah. And a fire was kindled in their company. The flame burned up the wicked. That's a reference to what we just read before. Yea, they despised the pleasant land, they believed not his word, but murmured in their tents and hearkened not unto the voice of the Lord. A detailed and vivid account of these murmurings is given in our Sidra, which we've already read, so I'm going to skip it. You can glance over. The last pasuk is Va'atana Shenu Yaveshar, our souls are dried up. Ain kol bilti al ha'meninu, all we have to look at all day is the man. That's all we have. Note that these words were uttered by the generation of the wilderness on the middle of page 97, which had gone forth from slavery to freedom, from darkness to light, from bondage to redemption. Yet this is how they pictured their experiences in Egypt, only just over a year after that crowning act of liberation from a nightmare of persecution, hard labor, and the casting of their children into the river. That's all they could think of.
True colors, that's what I said.
Or rosy, the grass is always greener. I'm not sure it's true color. Our sages expressed astonishment, and I'm not sure even if it is true colors, I'm not sure we could fault them for it. That's going to be the question. Our sages expressed astonishment at this idyllic
because
picture
of their
say. One minute. Let's wait till we get to the end to discuss that part. Our sages expressed astonishment at this idyllic picture of their stay in Egypt where they were fed free of charge. The real question is, this is what we ask. You're remembering back to, we asked two questions. One, we said, if you're complaining about the meat, why are you remembering the fish? That's a question we'll get to later. But the first question is, why are you remembering something that didn't happen? What do you mean you got fish for free? So the rabbis asked the question, we remember the fish. Does it say that the Egyptians actually gave them fish for nothing? Surely it is stated, now go and work, for no straw shall be given to you. If they wouldn't give them straw for free, would they have given them fish for free? How then do I explain the term of chinam, what does free for free mean? Free from divine commandments.
Oh, they didn't have to make brachas.
At the very least.
At the very least.
This explanation, interpreting the Hebrew word chinam, free, in the sense of free from the precepts, sounds far removed from the world of their murmurings. It's not what they're saying.
No.
They say, we got it for free. Let's see what other commentators have to say. So if you'll take a look at your sheet, she doesn't bring you Ibn Ezra, she just says, in course number one, I brought you Ibn Ezra. Chinam, what does it mean when they say, we remember the fish that we got him in Mitzrayim, chinam, for free? Ibn Ezra says, bizol, for very cheap. Ki'ilu chinam, as if it was for free, and I put a box around the footnote, and then I brought in the footnote. According to Ibn Ezra and many of the literalists who read who interpret the Torah, they interpret something like this as hyperbole, as exaggeration. So it wasn't that they got it literally for free. They got it almost for free. In other words, they had it very cheaply. So then we're going to have to explain how
so
was
plentiful.
It that is that
it was
true.
So plentiful. They were right there by the water.
This explanation, so let us see what other commentators have to say. Ibn Ezra explains on three lines from the bottom on page 97. Ibn Ezra explains that free is not literally meant, but that these commodities were cheap, available, as it were, at giveaway prices. Ibn Ezra often takes biblical phraseology hyperbolically. The question is whether his approach fix the picture here. Were the Israelites grumbling against the expensiveness of their food and nostalgically recalling its cheapness in Egypt? Surely not. Why? How much money did they have to pay for the money that they collected every morning?
Nothing.
Exactly. You know, so you...
So what are they complaining
about? You take for granted what you get so easily.
Of course. That's definitely part of what's the root of what's going on here. Unlike other commentators strive to adhere to the literal commentation of chinam is free, for nothing. Ramban explains as follows. He explains, the Egyptian fishermen, and I brought you the Hebrew if you want to look at it later, the Egyptian fishermen allowed them to take the fish caught in the nest, as is the custom among fishermen. Similarly, cucumbers and leeks were so plentiful in Egypt that whenever they were employed in the vegetable gardens, they were allowed to eat them. That's his first explanation. That either that whatever they caught in their nets they were allowed to keep,
or
that's the rule of the fishermen in terms of the fish, or in addition that the cucumbers and leeks, that whenever they worked in the vegetable garden, it was accepted that they were going to take something.
Anyway, take it.
Right. Or perhaps the Israelite slaves of the king worked for him and were only provided with a frugal diet of bread and water. They would therefore forage for food in the fields and gardens, eat of the vegetables, and no one bothered them, as is the practice where the king's slaves are concerned. In other words, everyone knew that all they got was bread and water, so when they saw them rummaging around to get their free fish and free food, that they let them go. Get it? Or at the riverside, they would be given the small fishes, which have no value in Egypt, as I have already explained in Exodus. And then, of course, she's going to bring us what he says in Exodus. Let's look in the Hebrew, since I brought it anyway. Number three, and she translates it. The Odin, in the middle of his interpretation on that, he's talking about the levels of
slavery.
Thank you. The Od Gazra Lehem Avodot Kashot, in addition, he decreed evil, hard work on them, Bechomer V'Levenim, with their clay and their bricks. Kimitzchila, from the beginning, Hayu Hasorin Nilahem HaLevenim. In the beginning, the officers would give them the bricks, Bayu Anshe Hamash Bonim HaBinyan. And the people had to build a certain, they had a certain quota that they had to build of a city, or of the building. And now, the people were, in other words, like originally the people who owed the tax, and it was like a building tax, and instead of paying money for the building tax, you actually built it. So the officers would give you the bricks and say, build it. That's your building taxes. You have to put in the time to build this building. And now, Nahagu Ha'am Ba'avodah, now the nation is in the everybody's working. V'tzivam, he commands them, she'yu meviyim afar, bring them the dust, v'osim hachomer b'yadeyem u'b'raglehem, and they had to make the mortar with their hands and their feet. V'lo yinatein lehem mi'beit ha'melech rak ha'tzavem no'vad, all that they're given from the Beit HaMelech, from the king's house, is the straw. V'notnim ha'levenim l'anshe ha'mas ha'bonim l'asot ha'binyan, he's describing the bricks. Then those bricks that the Jewish people made would then be given to the forced laborers, those who owed the building tax, and they would build the building.
Say that again.
Before, let's say you owe building tax, okay? You're a forced laborer. You owe building tax. So you were a person. Yeah, whatever. You're a citizen of Egypt, okay? So you, Bani Torgo, you owe building tax. Okay? So I'm your
master.
Chief person, I hand you the bricks, I say, build me this building. When you're finished with the building, you go home. That's your building tax, that's what you owe. But now, you're not the only person who's working. Now, Shifi, who before has been, you know, doing whatever else she was doing, because she's Jewish, I'm pulling her in to do work. So where do I get the bricks from? Now, I give Shifi
my bricks.
Only straw. No. I give
she
her straw. I say,
bricks.
Make bricks and mortar. She makes the bricks and mortar, and I give them to you, and then you build your building. Now that's hard work to
that's
make straw.
I'm so tired.
There you go. That's why you're so tired.
But you had all the fish for free.
Right. So what happened then? The bricks then are okay. All the heavy labor. Kol avodat kasha asher leparo lemitzrayim basadeh. All the hard work that was in the fields, kagon hachapirot b'hotat hazveilim, like all the digging and taking out all the weeds and stuff. Not just the weeds, the garbage, the dung and whatever. Hakonat nu alehim, all of that went on the Jews. Vegam hayu rodim lahem litchok otam, they would like force them, they would whip them, they would curse them to egg them on, to get them to do more work. Shalo yanuchu umakim umakalim lahem otam, they would really torture them to get them to work. Vezetam et kol avodotam asher avdu bahem b'far. This is what the Torah means, and it says that they made them work very hard. The king would pay them the lechem tzar, with poor bread.
Moldy bread.
Old bread, right. Kimin haglib ho'alei ha'melech, as was the custom for the king's workers. In other words, you're both in the employ of the king.
Right.
So what are you going to get paid with? A crust of bread.
Moldy
bread. This is what the mitzavim were talking about. This is what the complainers were talking about later in the Midbar when they said, remember the food that we had for free, the fish we had for free in Egypt, and the squash. There's a lot of fish in Mitzrayim. They would take from the fishermen at the, like the fishermen were commanded to allow them to take the fish. They would take from the gardens, they would take squash and watermelons. Nobody would stop them because it was at the command of the king. No one would bother them because it was at the king's order. In other words, the king would officially pay them a crust of bread. But it was understood everyone else felt bad for them and would let them have like the extra stuff. So really, did they have fish for free? According to Rabban, did they have fish for free in Mitzrayim? Yeah, they really did. They had fish and they had all these fresh vegetables. really for free.
But it was but
they worked
labor.
For it.
They definitely did, right.
And not only that, but once they got the stuff, I'm assuming they had to prepare it. So not only are you retired from all the work that you do,
right.
So now you got this stuff, the fish and the vegetables, you have to prepare it.
Right.
Well, guess what? With money, you don't have to
it's
do that.
It's all there. You could if you want to, but yeah.
Right. So it's like the adage of they had too much free time on their hands.
Right.
And
right.
So what did they do? They complained.
Exactly. Right. So here we have so far, we have the Midrashers said that they were happy that before they got the food free of mitzvot. We had Ibn Ezra who said they were complaining, but they were exaggerating, that it wasn't really for free, it was just low charge, as, you know, almost nothing. And Ramban says that no, it really was for free. So Rabban Hanel similarly explains Chinam as literally free of charge, but he adds to the Sifrei's question, Sifrei's question being, if they're not going to give them straw, like they're not giving them bricks, you know, they're not giving them the materials that they need to build, are they going to give them food for nothing? So he asked another question. What was the implication of their question? Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish. If they hankered after meat, then surely fish is no substitute. Admittedly, those who hankered after meat said in Beshalach, and we read this already, would that we had died by the hands of the Lord sitting by the flesh pot. But here they do not speak to the point since they began with the subject of meat and immediately shifted to fish and other foods, which are neither fish nor flesh. Right? They say, give us meat. Who's going to give us meat? We remember the fish and the vegetables that we had in Mitzrayim. Like, you're going totally off topic here. If you want meat, talk about meat. Say, we remember the meat we had in Mitzrayim, like you did back in Mishalach. Here you're saying, who's going to give us meat? And then you just go off on fish and vegetables. He answers these two questions together as follows. This is a Bravanel. Their statement, we remember it in the middle, page 99. I brought a few in the Hebrew, but we'll do it in English tonight. Their statement, we remember the fish we ate in Egypt for naught, was to anticipate the argument with which Moses might have countered, why do you grumble about the lack of meat? Did you then eat meat in Egypt? You certainly had no meat in Egypt when you were impoverished and needy, and meat was very expensive. In other words, what are you asking for meat for? You never had meat before. Why do you think all of a sudden now you're going to have meat? Therefore, they said, if we didn't eat meat in Egypt, at least we ate fish, since it was plentiful there from the waters of the Nile. We didn't even need money to buy it, since it could be got free of charge from the Nile waters overflow. All one had to do was dig a hole, which was filled by the waters of the river. When the Nile receded, the fish remained in the pits, and in this way they ate them free of charge. Now, even though at this point, I stopped in the middle
sushi.
Of the paragraph.
They
what?
Ate sushi.
They ate sushi,
sushi.
Exactly.
No preparation.
We'll get there. We're going to stop here at the middle. I stopped in the middle of the paragraph of this small writing. And I present to you, and I think you'll agree with me, that at this point we have a typesetting error in our edition, that you should, at this point, move to the larger type. Whether we accept the Ravenel's explanation that the fish were free, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right. Ravenel's not going to say that. Yeah. So she's saying, whether we accept the Ravenel's explanation that the fish were free due to the specific nature, natural conditions which allowed everyone the opportunity to procure fish, or Nachmanides, that it was a special privilege according to the king's workmen, we may learn from here how powerful is the selective ability of memory. Whatever your reason is why you remember getting them free, mm-hmm. you're not remembering the strings that were attached to your getting it for free. The terrible price they had to pay for this giveaway diet, slavery, suffering, persecution, murder of their children is conveniently forgotten. What remained, the fish they ate freely without paying for them. Har's ulterior motive in providing the fish is emphasized in Midrashei Torah by this Rabbi Ashtruk. You can look again in the back of your books because it's not in the back of this one. In some of the volumes in the back, so we'll go through the who the people are. Yeah, and I didn't look into it before because I assumed that it was in the back of the book. Okay. Here's what he says. Rashi writes, the chinam here means chinam from mitzvot, free of divine precepts. The object that straw was not provided them, never mind fish, forced him to resort to this explanation. But perhaps straw they were not given for the express design of making them work hard, while food they were prepared to give them in generous amounts and free. For how could they work hard and attain good results on an empty stomach? Notice that they didn't give them the bricks. But they gave them food so that they would work well. But they certainly supplied them with food to get the most out of them. Apt in this context is Solomon's proverb, the righteous man knows the soul of his beast, but the mercies of the wicked are cruel. In other words, the really good man understands the needs of his beast, that it has toiled enough, and he feeds it with a measure of barley in accordance with what it requires for such labor. The wicked man, on the other hand, gives it a double or triple measure and then works at double its capacity. His mercy in giving it more food is really cruelty to drive it mercilessly and beyond its normal capacity. This is a very interesting perspective because it's taking into account who Paro was and the evil in his whole plan. Accordingly, the grumblers did not realize the full bitterness of the irony in their words. Admittedly, they had been provided with fish for nothing in Egypt, but they had not understood the real import of Paro's generosity as expressed in the rabbinic dictum cited by Rashi in verse 22 of our chapter, "If flax and herbs be slaughtered." Here, we can turn there for a minute. Verse 22 in our chapter. Moshe, at the beginning, go to verse 21 for a minute. You know what, let's not skip. Let's read through where we left off instead. Page 788 in the middle. We'll get the rest of the story. I'm on Pasuk Zayin. Verse 7. Okay, they just complained. They said, all we look at is the man on page 788. The Haman Kizragad, who, by the way, says the narrator, in case you're wondering, the man looked like a coriander seed, ve'eino ke'en habdolach, and its appearance was like a crystal. Shatu ha'am v'laktu v'tachanu b'rechayim, the nation would go and get it, they would gather it, and they would grind it with grindstones, o'zachu b'mzocha, or they would pound it in a mortar, uvishlu b'parua, they would cook it in a pot, v'ashu otoko, make it into cakes, v'hayat ha'amo k'tam l'shad ha'shaman, and it tasted like dough that was dipped in oil. Uvaredet ha'tal ala machana laila, the dew would fall down on the camp at night, yared haman alav, and the man would fall on top of it. And then, by the way, another layer of dew would fall over it. When you woke up in the morning, that dew would evaporate, and the man was left over a layer of dew to protect it from the floor of the midbar, which is, by the way, the reason we use a challah board and a challah cover on Shabbos to cover the two challahs that are reminiscent of the man, of the double portion of man. I mean, that was the Jews' first introduction to Shabbos, was the halachas of the man. The reason we actually use a challah board and on top of the challah a cover is to remind us of those two layers of chal that protected the man both on the bottom and on the top. So
not
just to let you know.
On our tablecloth.
No, and that's necessarily not embarrass the wine. Right. Although the halachic reason for it also is while the bread is on the table with the wine, halachically you may not make the bracha on the wine over the bread. Right. So covering it makes it as if the bread is not on the table. Right. Mm-hmm. To emphasize the halachic side of it, many people will, and we do this in our house, as soon after we make the bracha and drink the wine, we remove the challah cover and then go to wash. Mm-hmm. So, or if you don't do that, you should make the bracha on the challah lifted up with the board and the cover. Mm-hmm. Those are the two ways to do it. You take the challah cover off before you make the bracha. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, it's a little pointless. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If the whole point to cover it was for the bracha, then you should take it off as soon as the yayin bracha is finished with, right? And if you're doing it to remember the man, then you should leave the bracha altogether with it covered. The whole thing.
Yeah,
like
why do we put the two loaves together?
I don't know everything.
Oh. Before we put the salt, before we make the bracha.
Right, you hold them together. I mean, I think you are making the bracha on both pieces.
You hold one above the other.
So, yes, on Shabbos day, well, even covering, on Shabbos night we cut the bottom one, on Shabbos morning we cut the top one. Okay, anyway, so that was the month. So then Moshe turns, Vayishma Moshe at Ha'am, Moshe heard the nation complaining, Bochel l'mishvachotah, they're crying in their families, which by the way, this similar language is used later when the Meraglim come back with their negative report. They're crying with their families. You know, this is so terrible. Yishma Petach, hello everyone in their tents. Ayichar at Hashem Ma'od, God was fuming, Ubeini Moshe Ra was bad in Moshe's eyes. V'omer Moshe Hashem, Moshe says to God, God, Lama Hari Yotel Abdecha, like what did I do to you? Why are you giving me such stories here, Hashem? To put the burden of this nation upon me. Was I not pregnant with this nation? Did I not give birth to this nation? Was I pregnant with this nation? Did I give birth to this nation that you said to me, carry it, like the nursemaid carries the young baby? On the land, you know, to the land that you promised your forefathers. What? This isn't my nation. Why are you putting this in my land? May I am libasala te lochalam and say, where am I get? I'm in the middle of a stinking desert. Where am I going to get meat from to give all these people? They're crying to me saying, give me meat so we can eat it. I cannot carry this whole nation by myself. It's too heavy for me. If this is what you're going to do for me, just kill me now. Wow. If you like me at all, kill me now. So you shouldn't see the evil that I'm going through. Hashem said to Moshe, gather 70. The Canaan gather 70 elders from Israel that you know that they are like really good people, which by the way Rashi says, how does he pick the 70 people? These are 70 people. The Jews had Jews who were in charge of them. Sound familiar? The Jews had Jews who were in charge of them, and then the Egyptians were in charge of those Jews. And the Egyptians would beat the Jewish
capos,
right, so to speak, and the Jews would not beat their underlings. Of Jews. They would take the beatings and say, we'll get there, we'll get there. And they would take the beatings in place of their Jewish
charges.
Thank you. Okay. So these 70 people narrated, he says, bring them all to the Ohel Moed, stand them there. I'm going to give them from some of the Ruach, some of the spirit, the godly spirit that's on you, Moshe, I'm going to give some of it to them. They're going to help you carry the weight of this nation. You won't have to carry it yourself. So he tells them, goes to the whole nation, he says, get ready for tomorrow, eat meat, because he cried in Hashem's ears, and he said, who's going to give us meat, because it's better for us in the time, and Hashem's going to give you meat, and you're going to eat it. Not for one day, not for 2 days, not 5 days, not 10 days, not 20 days, for a month, until it comes out of your mouth. Because you disgusted Hashem with your complaint that we're crying in front of him, saying, why did you take us out of the time? Bayomer Moshe says, on page 792, Sheish Meot Elef Ragli, Ha'am Asher Anochi B'Kirbo. There are 600,000 men among the people in which I am. Ha'amaita B'Sharitim Lahem. Hashem, he turns to Hashem, he says, and you're telling me you're going to give them meat for a month? He says, Hachon U'Bachai U'Bachai Yishachet Lahem U'Matzah Lahem Imet Kol Zigei Hayam Yisef Lahem U'Matzah Lahem. Like, I don't even have enough cattle to slaughter for them. Even all the fish in the sea isn't going to be enough for them, he says to them. Okay, so I did all that to bring to you. says Rashi here. Okay. And here's how she says in verse 22 of our chapter, flocks and herbs he slaughtered, herds, but should say herds, not herbs, he slaughtered. We say, says Rashi, right, we say to the donkey, to the ass, take this measure of barley and then we'll cut off your head. Like, is that what you're doing to the Jewish people? You're going to give them all this food and then, like, for what purpose?
Okay. And it's going to come out of their noses.
Right. So Luchato Shadal, Rav Shlomo David, Shmuel David Luchato, who is a contemporary of George Washington, I would say, although on the other side of the ocean, it's unclear. We've done him before.
What's his name?
Rav Shmuel David Luchato Shadal. From Spain. He might be, but not from Spain. Italy. Perhaps. He is unclear where he fell on the Hashkafic line spectrum. Spectrum, I would say. Timeline on the spectrum. If you look at his picture, he does not look like his Orthodox contemporaries. He was beardless and quite within the styles of the times, although his Parshanut, his commentary on the Torah, is quite within, in defense of Orthodox. Yes.
which is beautiful.
One of the things
he said,
not only does he say something she likes, the whole purpose, I'm sorry that it's cold in here, I don't control the...
I'm going to get my jacket.
Okay, that's a good idea. So one of the things that his thing is known for, his commentary is known for, is that he writes to combat the biblical criticism, the people who said,
there's a lot of it.
Right, okay. So he based his solution of the problem on historical proofs and consideration. Here's what he said. The word chinam on page 100 in the Chama. The word chinam implies nothing less than free of charge. In other words, he says it means really free. Since the Egyptians supported the Israelites, providing them with cheap items of food such as fish and cucumbers, which were plentiful in Egypt, we find that Herodotus informs us that on one of the Egyptian pyramids was an inscription reading that the king who erected it expended 1,600 measures of garlic and onions on food for the workmen. Herodotus further states that the Egyptians did not themselves eat fish, and it was therefore understandable why they gave it to the Israelites. Does this sound familiar? Of you giving your cleaning lady your chametz before Shabbat?
Mm-hmm.
Before Pesach? Thank you.
What?
They just did it.
What does that have to do with the cleaning line?
No, the Indians
they're
giving you, but they're giving the stuff that they're not using.
Hitherto, we have cited all those who try to explain the text literally, who wish to answer the question of the sages in terms of the tricks that memory deliberately plays with the person. They forgot the injustice they had suffered. Only pleasant memories remained of the generous helpings of food given them. The reason underlying this generosity was of no concern to them. But it seems to us that our rabbis, back to our original comment that she made, evinced a profounder understanding of the Israelites' character. Was it really and truly the fish and cucumbers that prompted this outcry on the part of the Israelites? Perhaps this was merely the outward form their inner dissatisfaction took. A community will accept suffering and want with enthusiasm and eagerness, provided the ultimate aim of it all is one which appeals to them or with which they can identify themselves. No sacrifice of convenience, property, health, and even those near and dear will be too great, provided the goal is valued and sacred in their eyes. On the other hand, when discontent lurks in the heart of the public or individual, grumblings and murmurings, criticism and defamation will flare up at the slightest pretext. You all know this. We have this with our spouses, you know, our children, our friends, you know. I hate it when you wear that shirt. You not really hate the shirt. What happened today that's making you so testy to me? Who are you pretending I am? You know? But we have this in all of our relationships, you know, that where people will use as pretext if you're upset about something. So he's saying you're not really upset about the squash and the watermelons and the meat. There's something really deeper going on here. The most trivial difficulty will be magnified sevenfold, and even the tiniest inconvenience demands are regarded as a major violation of their rights. Mm-hmm. The real motive for the inner discontent is not explicitly expressed, either because the person is unaware of its cause, or because it springs from forbidden desires which have to be suppressed and concealed. Instead, the malcontents make much of trivial complaints and always have a grievance. The onlooker will be puzzled. Are these trivialities worth such an outcry? Like, it's a stinking sweater I'm wearing. His eye will not be able to distinguish between the pretext and the real cause lurking deep down. Our sages detected this. When they said chinam, they meant free of mitzvot, say Chazal. Not food or drink, fish or cucumbers, whether given away or cheap, fresh or stale, really concerned them. But that freedom from the irksome demands of civilization and standards of self-discipline which they had enjoyed in Egypt. The Talmud observed that a slave enjoys his license. The master does not interfere in the private lives of his slaves, does not bother about their moral and educational training. On the contrary, the more the slave is ruled by his senses, the better for the master. Let him get drunk, fight, indulge in promiscuity. I'm on page 102. And expend his superfluous energies on such outlets rather than listen to words of falsehood, of freedom, liberation from the toils of his bondage. You know, like, I don't care if my slave gets drunk. Just don't let him listen to those intellectuals who think that his freedom is really what's better for him. Let him not think of his self-respect, a man created in the image of God, daily trodden underfoot by his persecutor. It is not the master's business to teach him ethics and conduct. His slave is like his beast of burden, and the slave is satisfied with that.
Table?
From what?
The Italian.
No, this is Nechama. When the Israelites went forth from slavery to freedom, another bondage was imposed on them, more difficult and majestic in its awesomeness. The yoke of Torah and mitzvot imposed on them at Sinai, self-discipline in the life of the community and individual, in family life, in relations with neighbors, on work days and rest days, in matter of food and drink and clothing, and most important, in matters of sex. This yoke so dear to the one who accepts it willingly, to the one who has studied Torah and been enlightened to appreciate its luster and experience its taste, this yoke of freedom appeared to those accustomed to slavery as burdensome and irksome. You hear how she calls it a yoke of freedom. This, in the view of our sages, was the cause of all the grumblings about water, bread, and meat, and the fish they ate for nothing in Egyptian bondage. Free? Of course. Yonder we ate fish free. Free from mitzvot. Free from the yoke of Torah and mitzvot. This, too, is the interpretation by the sages to the following verse, which describes the behavior of the grumblers. Moshe heard the people weep throughout their families. Say, Chazal. Reb Naharai used to say, this indicates that the Israelites were annoyed when Moshe told them to refrain from forbidden sex relations. We may understand from this that a man would marry his sister or his father's or mother's sister. When Moshe ordered them to desist from such practices, they were annoyed. They wept to their families. Since they had become inured to sin, they had no shame about it. They vented their complaints publicly, assembling their families together with them for the purpose. Rashi abbreviates the words of the Sefer and combines the two explanations. Weep throughout the family. Say Rashi. We could look at it right here. We have it in the original. Those of you who can read the Rashi script. On page 788, B'chol L'mishpachot Tav. Pasuk Yud, Mishpachot, Mishpachot, Nasvim U'Bochim. Families would gather, family after family assembled together, L'far same Tar'umotam B'Giloy. To voice their grievance publicly. V'rabotenu amru, and a rabbi say, L'mishpachot Tav, related to family. Al iskei mishpachot, about family, our arayot ha-nasharim lam, on the forbidden relations to them. Thus, in this text, too, says Nechama, she finishes up on page 103, as with the previous one of we ate in Egypt for nothing, the literal explanation is limited to the surface meaning, whereas the homiletic exposition uncovers a deeper level of meaning. So adapt another biblical text from 1 Samuel, the plain sense looks from the outward appearance, but the homiletic sees into the heart. What were the Jewish people? You said earlier, Mani, you started off talking about their true colors.
Yeah.
That it reveals who they really, truly are. What are they really, really upset about? They had a life with no moral guidance.
Right. No more, no guidance.
This is what the rabbis say. Go ahead.
The saying goes, as a born pricht a rein and harang is happy.
Well, that's why I said the yates of harm.
That they don't think there is anything
that's
better.
That's right. They think that's their life. They don't know any different men.
Right.
And well, it's easy to be a slave because you don't have to think.
They didn't know any differently.
And then they got all these mixes, and all of a sudden they had to start.
It's like the Russians coming to America. They were completely assimilated. They had no idea Yiddish type. That was their life. They came with certain things that they had been born and raised into, like never trust the police. Bribery is the only thing that works. Never tell anybody you're a Jew. This was
it's ingrained.
It's ingrained. I mean, this is recent people. I know my cousins when they came.
You have it even in America, people who grew up from versus people who didn't grow up from and became from later on.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, people who became from at a normal, steady pace, the chance of them leaving from Chai is not very high. They appreciate the Judaism. They came to it for themselves. They chose it. Here, the Jewish people, I'm not so sure they really chose it. Hashem knew what
That's
was
right.
better for them, and they think they know what's better for them. And it's, you know, they're expressing a feeling, whereas we say to them, you saw miracles every day, how could you complain like this? When you see it this way, the way Chazal
Maybe
saw
it. Being too harsh.
1 minute. When you see it the way Chazal saw them, say they were upset about the mitzvot, the weight of the mitzvot, the yoke of the mitzvot, they saw the mitzvot as a burden. That's a challenge that we experience. It's very easy for us to experience. I mean, just think of 3-day Yom Tov. You know? Mm-hmm. Yoke of the mitzvot.
Mm-hmm.
Is there. Think of Pesach. Think of summer, if you're not, you know, and you know, summer and swimming, and think of kosher Tisha B'Av,
and
having to pack all your food when you're driving cross country or whatever. You know, these are, it could be seen as very burdensome.
Yeah.
So we are very quick to fault the B'nai Israel, but if you think about it, it's not so far-fetched. And yet, these are still the people that objectively Hashem chose to give them the Torah. And if they, even with all their questions, Hashem gave them the Torah, that we can see also, even though we have, I mean, especially us here, let's look at this microcosm of us in this group. We all appreciate Torah, because if we didn't, we wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
Week after week after week.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We appreciate the beauty of Torah. And they have good taste too, right? Once in a while, I throw in a good joke also.
No,
you know? But no garlic in my cake. But we appreciate Judaism, and yet we also, at times in our lives, feel the burden of the Judaism that it is. You know?
Yeah,
and
we like
want the fish, exactly. We want the fish.
Like zero.
You know? But I think that it's important if we realize, if we look at this story from the other side and remember.
Right.
But if you remember that they still got the Torah, these are still the people Hashem knew who they were.
Always.
This is like, you know, the thing about their true colors. Hashem didn't know their true colors. Hashem knew their true colors. Hashem knew who these people were. And yet he gave them the Torah, and it's up to us to see the beauty of the Torah that we have. So I give you the bracha this week that if it gets burdensome, God forbid, we should see the beauty of the Torah that we study. And we will see you next week, Mr. Hashem.